and I'll have a big party, and I'll put you both on the guest list, plus one. I'm gonna have a man who does magic. He's really good. Not like cheesy magic, like good magic.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul.
And I'm Dennis Freeba.
All the way 3,000 miles apart, 2,000, something like that. I drove it, I should know. I think it's like 2,500-ish. But we are doing a long-distance relationship now because those work out so well.
They do. They work out really well. It's just about communication, and we have Skype, so we can do that.
We do. And, you know, we can get through this. We have that type of solid relationship where
– I'm just going to let you go find yourself, Nick, okay?
That's why I appreciate you so much, because you allow me to be me and follow my dreams of going broke. But this is season 5 of Two Magicians. I think it's – is it season 5? I think so.
I think so, yeah.
In my notes, because we take a couple months off and then we'll start back up. If you haven't listened to us before, please go back and listen to our interviews and our nonstop blabbering about magic and being magicians and the absurd world that we live in. But so basically the format, I think, for season 5 is going to be Dennis and I are going to chit-chat a little bit up top, and then we're going to go into an interview. I haven't decided if this is going to be a bi-weekly or weekly podcast. We were doing every other week last season just because for time constraints, but I will attempt to do every week. So please subscribe in iTunes or on Stitcher and rate us if you like us. If you don't like us, don't rate us. Don't just keep it to yourself.
Yeah, that's not good for our numbers.
Nobody on the internet ever says bad things about anybody. But Dennis, so I left the theme park game, and you are still over at the place that has a mouse as a mascot. So how's that been going?
Oh, fantastic! It's actually been cold lately. We're at 59 degrees right now.
Ooh.
And I think it's supposed to start getting down into the 30s.
Oh wow!
So yeah, it's going to be cold for the next probably month and a half or so, on and off, you know, which, going up and down.
Which, to specify, if people don't know, you perform outside.
Yes. Yeah, that matters.
And when the audience, because it's Florida, and when it starts to get that cold, audiences go from like 100 people to 10 people very quickly.
Yeah. But yeah, everything's going really well over there. Still plugging away at it. Little bits at a time.
Have you, for me, like the biggest thing I've noticed, and it's a good and a bad thing, is like, because you're doing like 16 shows a week, I was doing 12, and for me, I noticed that the biggest thing I miss is just kind of working on muscle memory and working on getting the show into your body, because you're able to repeat it and do it over and over so many times. And I don't think I've lost anything, but I certainly haven't been able to work on stuff as specifically as I could before. And that's certainly something I greatly miss. And I forget where I was going with this, but
well, I think you were wondering like how that differs for me, I think.
Yeah. I mean, because at least for me, when I'm doing private events now, I it sounds weird, but I look forward to the shows more than I was. Not that I wasn't before, but
right.
Just doing that many shows a week and then adding extra shows on top of that, it feels like a job as opposed to just performing. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Well, there's a certain like level of flexibility that you start to have when you're doing the shows on a regular basis every single day of the week. So you're able to really explore, I think, different areas much more frequently and with much more ease and comfort. Whereas like if you're just doing a show once a week or once every month or every once in a while, you always want to put your best foot forward. And so you're, I think, going to be sometimes a little bit more careful about what you do and take less risks. But when you're doing it on a regular basis, it doesn't matter where you're at, you're always going to want to take the risks, because you know that within a few minutes or within a few hours or a few days, you're going to be doing it again anyways and have another shot at it.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference in terms of not worrying as much.
So do you find yourself being a little bit more reserved, or like, are you still like, just, whatever, I'll do it?
I think it depends on the show I'm doing. It depends on, you know, I've been trying to do more variety alternative comedy crowds out here to see if, because, it's a very different audience from doing tourists and families to going and performing in front of people that watch a lot of stand-up comedy and are kind of hip and, you know what's going on. So for me, it's been a challenge because I'm trying to push myself, but other times I do want to play it safe because I don't want to bomb in front of these people.
You're right. Yeah, exactly.
But in terms of repetition, I've been going to the castle, the Magic Castle, a lot, and you'll see a lot of guys, you know, working in the basement, working on stuff over and over, doing the same type of thing. Even if they're not necessarily getting paid, you know, they're down there working and trying to, you know, I have a friend who's just working his show nonstop, trying to figure out all the little details. And I think that's such a great advantage of the repetition of doing a show. Like, sure, you can get sick of it.
Yeah, it's like also an open mic for magicians. That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have to tiptoe that line of getting sick of it and also just getting it into your body to the point of, because there are some guys that can go up and, you know, work it, you know, doing something only a couple times, and, you know, they go up there and they look like they've done it 1,000 times. But guys like me, you know, I really need to know the ins and out of a trick or a routine before I can get up in front of an audience. You know, I need to know every little second. So I'm not sure where you stand on that.
It just kind of depends on what it is. I will usually, when I'm working on a routine, I'll work on it in bits and pieces. I'll do certain things like the routine, let's say it requires a force of a card and then a control of a forced card and then a revelation of that. I will practice each individual phase separately at different parts in my show, like just as almost as a throwaway. Like I just try it and see what happens, you know. So I'll try this force a bunch of times. And then finally, when I have the force part of it down, I'm like, okay, so I got the force down. Now I can go to the next part of it, and which is the controlling of the card. And then I practice that, and then I bring that into the show and practice it separately or in conjunction with something else, you know, just to get the technique in or whatever it is that I'm working on. So I build it in little bits and pieces. So a lot of times, like, one routine will be something for like 6 months, and then I finally get it down. And now I can add the new element in making it the routine I originally wanted it to be, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And you have the advantage too. And I've noticed a couple guys do this at the Magic Castle. You have the advantage of having multiple endings to a trick. You know, if something happens, you're able to go with it, and you're not always allowed to do that in, you know, a corporate function or a set show where you only have, you know, you're only doing one 45-minute thing.
And right.
That's certainly something I miss about working at Disney, is that, you know, if something strange happened or if somebody named a particular card that rarely gets named, you're able to create this super magical moment and or, you know, whatever the situation is, but you're able to play with, oh, this happened, so therefore I can, from A, I can go to B or whatever. And it's not a set, you know, beginning, middle, and end. And that's kind of a really, and I've seen a lot of guys at the castle do that. I've watched a show where I'm like, oh my God, how did he get that? And then I'll go back and I'll watch, I'm giving away stuff, but, you know, whatever, magicians listen to this. And I'll go back and watch it again. I'm like, oh, he didn't end it the same way. Interesting.
Right.
And, you know, for those people seeing, you know, both versions of the trick, they're still equally amazed, but one is able to be so much more exciting. And that's a cool advantage you have of being at a venue over and over, whether it's a restaurant or whatever.
Yeah, I actually tend to shy away from those type of tricks at the board. We get people that go back and forth constantly. So if I have an ending that varies too much from the best potential outcome, then I feel like I've given it away, you know?
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you do have to be careful about that.
Whereas, like, I'm much more apt to do that at a corporate gig where I know that my options for the big finale or whatever are all great, you know, no matter what.
Yeah. And how have you managed to keep it fresh? I mean, because you've continued your contract. You've been there, what, 3-4 years now?
Yeah, I'm in the midst of my fourth year now. You know, it's just a matter of working on new things all the time, and not even material. You know, like sometimes it's just today I'm working on my posture, or tomorrow I'm, you know, working on lowering the register of my voice and seeing how that affects people. You know, putting in a new routine. You know, okay, I'm doing this week, and then I'm doing this, you know, next week. Bringing something old back. Going, I haven't done this in a long time. Let me bring this back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like how I tend to keep it fresh. Because for the most part, I do everything very similar, you know, throughout most of the shows. But as the years go on, the show evolves and I take certain pieces out and then I'll put the new piece in and then just build the new show, you know, piece by piece, kind of like I build a routine.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a sense, and it keeps it, you know, you got to keep it fresh and exciting for you. I mean,
right.
Just once again, going back to my unique perspective of walking away from doing 12 to 16 shows a week, now every show I do,
it's much more sacred.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because, you know, I've been lucky. I haven't had any failures since I left, but, you know, there's always that in the back of your mind where it's going to be just a debacle. And that was the one great advantage of Disney. It's like, if you have a terrible audience or a terrible show, you go and do it again in 15 minutes. And, it's easy to get used to that, you know, and sometimes you'll have a whole night of terrible audiences, and that sucks. That wasn't fun.
Yeah.
I would get those every once in a while. But yeah, I think what's hopefully good about starting this season is now we have two different perspectives on performing in different types of venues and
in different parts of the country, completely opposite ends.
And it's funny how I was thinking about this yesterday, how a lot of magic is regional. There are certain tricks in Florida that I would see a lot of guys do, and there's so far just hanging out at the castle a little bit here and there. Once or twice a week, seeing there's a lot of tricks I'll see over there that a lot of guys do. And it's wild how, and being from Detroit, you know, I learned a lot of particular magic tricks up there that I never saw anybody else do in other places. So that's been kind of fun to, it's almost like accents. Magic has its own dialect.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. I came from, you know, a very minimal side of magic where, you know, I didn't carry a table around. I didn't carry a close-up mat. Whatever table you're using, that's your table. You know, if it's a bare, just wooden bar table, that's what you're going to use. If it's, you know, a nice, you know, drape over it or something like that, then you can use that. But it was always about using the environment. And, so that was like something that I think I don't see a lot of people do when I go to different parts of the country or even different parts of the world that I've been to. You know, a lot of people, they carry their close-up mat around, they carry a case, they carry a table. So that's something that was, I think, very unique to the Northwest. You didn't see a lot of people doing things like that up there.
Yeah. There's certainly things I picked up from magicians at Disney that I would have never picked up. It's just kind of all who you perform with, you know, you start to become not a copy, but you start to learn little tricks and little.
Well, you become inspired, I think, is what it is. If you're doing it the right way, you're being inspired. If you're doing it the wrong way, you're copying and
sure,
you know, but if there's a sense of inspiration there, then yeah, you know, run with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes a big difference overall.
So out there, what is the, what is it like as far as like performing and getting connected? Has it been really hard, or have you just been like super lucky and getting stuff?
I made, you know, I wrote a whole blog post on this, you know, just like my first 2 or 3 months in LA. And LA is kind of fascinating because it's so saturated with magicians that it's, you know, I've had to lower my price a little bit just to book local things. But I'm booking a lot of stuff out of state, which is really, I've been traveling quite a bit. So that's been nice.
Good.
And it's just funny how, you know, just the price points change and you're doing the same thing, but because it's local and there's so many other magicians people can choose from, you have to, you know, be more competitive with your price. But everybody for the, either people have either been very welcoming or very, you know, shut off, you know, in terms of the people that I've met. And it's been more so welcoming, which has been great, you know, trying to network as much as I can. And that's been a fun kind of change, I think, from Florida. People were very friendly, but, you know, it was a little bit more of a challenge to get to know magicians. Here it's like everybody's a friggin' magician here, so it almost feels like that wall is kind of dropped a lot of the time. So that's been a learning experience, but a good one. So
do you think the castle has a lot to do with that?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, layman, you know, every local party I've done here, somebody asked me if I'm a member of the castle. You know, everybody knows about it, even if you're not a magician. Right. It's a very popular thing. It's a good thing to have. It's a good resource. And as long as you can kind of stay away from the politics of the castle, which I don't really know anything about, but I keep hearing, you know, through the grapevine of people, right. It's fine. But it's, you know, I've certainly become, in the 3 months I've been here, I've become a better magician just watching other performers and watching different styles. And sometimes you'll go to the castle and you'll see somebody perform and you leave and you're like, I hate my life because I'm never going to be as good as that in terms of skill. But that's, I think that's ultimately a good thing because it forces you to work harder and, you know, you don't get better by, you know, seeing stuff that's not good. You get better by seeing stuff that's amazing and go, okay, I have to work harder. And how can I do that? How can I be that good?
Right. Yeah. I try to focus on the things, like, cause some people just have like a natural gift at certain things. And so I try to focus on the, like, what is it that I am that good at? You know, this person is really good at that. What is it that I am doing that is that?
You have to keep that in the back of your mind because you'll see somebody do something. And like, I saw Carl Hine perform last weekend and it was amazing.
Oh, cool.
You know, he was just, I saw him in Florida and he blew everybody away. And, you know, when you get a standing ovation at the castle from magicians, you know, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And you have to also remember, it's like, oh, he clearly has some sort of a mathematical brain for some of the stuff he's doing. It's like, no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to be able to do what he's doing, you know? And that's okay. That's good. That's his personality and that's his character and that's his style. And
yeah, he's awesome. He's great.
It. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely recommend checking out his Rubik's Cube routine that he just put out on the market. I'm not sure where it's being sold, but it's pretty wild. But yeah, just little things like that where it's very inspiring and also very devastating sometimes because you can't think about it too hard because, you know, everybody is good out here and that's a great thing, but you have to figure out, okay, how do I be unique and how do I carve my own path?
Right.
Yeah, it's great. So I'm gonna throw this to the interview right now. Thanks. Good to talk to you, Dennis, and we'll talk to you real soon.
All right, man.
Testing 1, 2. Awesome. Well, we're just going to jump right in here. We have Joel Ward here today. How are you?
I'm good. I said that
really weird.
How are you?
It's a dramatic question right now.
Yeah,
off the top.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, I'm feeling quite dramatic this morning.
That's good. You threw your back out.
Yeah.
We're going to let everybody know about
that. Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah. I've never done this before. I was shoveling dirt.
Not like you were doing an epic stunt or anything.
Yeah, no, that was the part I've never done before. It was shoveling dirt. No, but I was shoveling dirt into the trash bins yesterday. I was getting rid of some extra dirt to put some wood chips down in the front yard, and I threw my back out.
And you're from San Diego, so you're not familiar with shoveling snow, I assume.
No.
Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah,
that's probably how you did it.
Yeah, probably. That's why I threw it out, yeah.
You don't have that experience.
Never picked up a shovel in my life.
The Detroit child in me who grew up in snow for 22 years.
22 years of I just can't imagine.
Well, it's even worse when I moved to Chicago. It's like snow and it's windy. Oh, wow. So you're walking around, you can't feel your face.
The worst I got to shoveling snow was I lived a year in Lake Tahoe. I was doing a show in Lake Tahoe. Okay. And the winter that bad was it was pretty bad that year. So yeah, I had to go from the third floor where I was staying to the first floor where I was performing. So I lived at the casino, so I didn't really have to shovel snow.
Okay. Yeah. If you did, that would be a really crappy gig. It's to also shovel the snow. Because I know there's like cruises that magicians have to do where they also have to play bingo with the guests.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paid like not well at all.
Yeah.
So how did you get your start in magic? You started kind of younger at the castle.
Yeah. So right? I was 6 years old when I saw a magician. When I was five, I wanted to be a brain surgeon. My dad really had cool idea that I should work in a hospital. He had worked in a hospital. I got inspired with that idea. And then I saw this magician when I was six. He did the Chinese linking rings. He pulled me up on stage. I was a really shy kid in the back. I had my arms crossed. I had no desire to be pulled up on stage. I didn't raise my hand or anything. And he pulled me up and I was like, oh my gosh, this guy is going to make a fool of me. I was really shy. And he gave me the two rings. He was doing Whit Hayden's four ring routine. Mm-hmm. And he said, on the count of three, they're going to link together. And they did. And I thought he was a magician. I thought I was the magician. I went home and told my parents that that's what I want to do. So, yeah.
Interesting. So, that's kind of what you... So, 6 years old, that's when it started.
So,
brain surgery went out the window.
It just totally went out the window, yeah. Which is probably was good that it happened then because... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just not that smart. Yeah, I don't think I could have lasted through the school.
No offense to brain surgeons, I've met a few.
Right.
Not the smartest guys in the world, but they do a great job and they get paid very well.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that is true.
It's not.
We kind of do the same thing, right? True. We mess with minds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With smaller copays. Mm-hmm. So why magic? Why do you think it influenced you in such a dramatic way at 6 years old?
Well, I think the initial bug was there, but I think it could have went either way at that point. I was inspired with magic, and I think I could have just done what a lot of boys did at that age and just like got a magic set and got into it. But my dad got this idea that if I was going to learn magic out of a magic set, that I was going to throw it in the closet and move on to the next hobby.
Hmm.
So he bought me Mark Wilson's Complete Course in Magic, the book.
Oh, yeah, that's how I started, too.
And so I think it was like a Costco set at the time, mm-hmm. and it came with like a few props. So we opened it up, and we learned the French drop together one Christmas morning, and he made the coin disappear, and I was like, oh, my God, how'd you do that? And he taught me how to do it. And then we kind of read this book together and learned all the sleight of hand, and I think doing it that way is the reason I kind of kept with it, because I kind of treated it more as like a craft, something that had to be learned, as opposed to a trick that could be opened and like it's like a puzzle, you know?
Yeah, that makes it much more similar to learning like guitar or something. There's always something more you can learn and pick up. It's
totally.
Like this is a never-ending project.
Yeah, so like magic and guitar, very similar, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
One gets you chicks, and one shoves you away from chicks.
Right, exactly.
But that's that's a great way to look at it, and I think that's why so many... Because I feel like every teenage boy goes through the magic phase,
totally.
You know, but it's very easy to let it go. Because you're like, oh, I've learned enough. And once you get through that kit or once you get through that DVD, it's like... Not where else do you go? But when you have like basically a whole encyclopedia, like Wilson, I still will reference that from time to time.
It's a great laying around. Oh, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always something in there that you can add or just go, oh, how do they do this routine this way? Or,
Yeah, exactly.
So that's good. That makes me feel less alone. So where do your influence? I'm always interested for people's influences outside of magic, you know, because there's especially in LA, you know, moving here, it's so saturated is not the right word, but there's a lot of magicians.
There's a lot of magicians, a lot of competition, a lot of people who come here to do their businesses, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's great about Los Angeles is everyone comes with a dream, you know, because it's the city of dreams. So it's like, everybody's like, I have a goal, right? So they come here with that dream. They, you know, a lot of people, you know, get... discouraged and leave, you know, sadly, or lose those dreams quickly. But that is the good part of this city, is like people really do come here for big ideas, mm-hmm. which is cool. I grew up just south of here in a little town called Cardiff by the Sea, which is like about 2 hours south, about 30 minutes north of San Diego, like proper. And it was like a little beach town. And, you know, so my influences were like surfing, body surfing, going to the beach, going to the campgrounds, like, you know, walking around this beach town and kind of just being outdoors a lot. You know, I was skateboarding and, mm-hmm. you know, being a little shit, you know, just running around town. I have an older brother, so he definitely, you know, showed me things that that I wouldn't have experienced probably just on my own. And yeah, it was, so I think my early influences came from that, you mm-hmm. know. It was like with all these like great fun activities to do every day, sports, you know, baseball, and then there was this magic. And I just kind of geeked out on the magic, and I kind of just ran with that. I mean, I did a lot of sports through probably like junior high, mm-hmm. and then I stopped. But yeah, maybe I just wasn't that good at sports. I'm not sure what it was. Yeah.
I feel like you're kind of an anomaly, because I don't know any other magicians who like sports.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are.
It's funny. Yeah.
That's kind of a... It's always like... Because I grew up doing theater in high school and right. college, so anytime there would be somebody in the theater department who also played football, it was just so weird to me.
Oh, it was completely... Yeah.
And then you were secretly jealous, because it's like, oh, you can do everything.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, because when we were talking about the basketball game when you first got here, you know, you were like, what? I was like, oh, wait, yeah, magician.
I try magician. So hard. Right, yeah. I try really hard.
Yeah, like, totally.
I have family members that are way into baseball and yeah. sports, and I'm just like, I understand why you care about this.
Yeah.
But for something genetically in me, I don't, but I respect it.
Well, I think it was just a lot of the kids in that area in North County, San Diego, were like, these fathers were like, you're going to be a professional baseball
sure,
player.
Sure, yeah.
You know? And a lot of my friends made it, you know, they went to the pros and, you know, started playing major league. So I think that was just kind of, it was a sports driven culture. Mm-hmm. And then I think with the magic, I was just kind of one of those things where I could just kind of escape into, and I started, meeting other like-minded magicians in the area, at an early age. And I started going to the local IBM and SAM rings. And then I joined the Magic Castle Junior program when I was 15, mm-hmm. and I would take the train up once a month. And I have an aunt and uncle and cousin that live here in Hollywood, so they would pick me up at the train station and just drive me to the castle, drop me off for the day. I would spend, you know, the day, you know, either practicing on the palace stage, like running the bird act at the time.
Oh, wow.
Or we would have like a lecture by people like Billy McComb or whoever was there that afternoon. And then we would be able to run around the library and show each other card tricks and kind of, I don't know. So that was really cool, like being able to meet other people who were also really good at magic at that yeah. time. You know, they were really excelling at it and they were geeking out as much or if not more than I was.
That's a wild opportunity, because you're literally in the epicenter of right. magic. You know, it's kind of like if you're an improviser, Chicago is kind of the Mecca.
Yeah.
The Magic Same Castle city, feels yeah. Yeah. like the Mecca for magic here, and that's wild to grow up, you know?
Yeah, because no, it is crazy.
A lot of people don't get to do that, you know?
Exactly.
And you kind of have to discover magic on your own, but you're literally at this, you know, university for magic.
Yeah, and I was so close, you know? San Diego, and then there's L.A., the Magic Castle, and then Vegas is so close. So we have this little triangle of
sure.
of just such great magicians and knowledge and... you know, places where we can learn, you know, from each other, which mm-hmm. was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously that influenced your style in a way, would you say?
I or guess so.
Did
yeah.
you get to
I
see
have
multiple
a,
styles?
No. Yeah. I think, I did like, I think early on when I started competing in magic contests, I pulled from other styles that I liked, you know, of course. And as I grew, you know, just finding myself as a performer, I found that I couldn't really pull these styles off because they weren't me. You know, I was just kind of borrowing.
That's an interesting discovery is, you know, I feel like for my first 5-10 years of doing comedy magic, I was just trying to be Jeff Hobson.
Okay.
And somebody even commented on one of my YouTube videos. Yeah. I always remember this. He's like, yeah. Jeff Hobson wannabe.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, imitation is the greatest form of flattery, but you do have to discover your own character and your own style. Totally.
I wanted to be Greg Fruin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Greg Fruin was just the man. I watched that World's Greatest Magic 1, his mm-hmm. Dove act on there with the yellow and green birds.
Yeah, I remember.
I watched it every day I was watching it so much that my little sister learned how to play just from ear his Cirque du Soleil song that he uses on the piano, and she would play it for me, like, as I would come into the room, and I would mime his act. Like, yeah. Yeah. But I loved it. Yeah, so I even ended up, I think I got my first, like, tux for the Dove act was no tails. It was like one of those waiter jackets, you know, but I was doing the bird act with no tails, and I thought, I was like, oh, I'm so cool, but I was really just biting off Greg Fruin.
When we were talking last week, you mentioned sneaking doves on airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
Is this something you're allowed to talk about? Because it sounds very fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's great.
Because I have a tough time getting our dog on the plane.
It's so funny. I've been doing this 15 years now, smuggling birds on planes. And I would have to say before 9/11, it was a lot more challenging.
Really?
After 9/11, so much easier.
Why is that?
So before 9/11... the airlines and TSA worked together, and you would need to show that you purchased a ticket for the animals mm-hmm. at security check-in, because TSA knew the airline rules. So you would go up there and you'd have a cage, and they'd be like, okay, where's the doves, you know? And if they weren't inside, then you could be like, oh, well, I'm taking the cage, you know, to Chicago, you know, to pick up some animals. And they're like, okay. So what I would do before 9/11 is I would wear two shirts. I would tuck in my lower shirt, undershirt into my pants. And then I'd stick the doves in my like back, like kind of just like loosely under the shirt. So there'd just be like this crowd of six birds on my lower back. And then I would put the cage through the X-ray machine. And then when I get to the other side of security, I would go into the bathroom and load them all into the cage and then step onto the plane. And this got really, like, scary, you know, because, you know, birds are rustling around your back. Like, I think one time I had a bird on each cargo pant. I was wearing cargos, and the bird started moving as I was being, like, examined, you know. But before 9/11, they couldn't touch you. Mm-hmm. They could only use that little, like, magic wand.
Yep.
You know, so one time, like, he saw a bird rustling in my pocket. He's like, what's that? I'm like, nothing. He's like, what's that? I'm like, nothing. And then he scanned it with the wand and wasn't able to find any metal. So he let me go. But I mean, that was the kind of sketchy, you know, pre 9/11. After 9/11, it got much simpler. TSA, the airline split.
Yeah.
They have no idea the rules for the airlines anymore. They're just for national security. So I tell the TSA now about the birds, and instead of putting them through the metal detector, I just throw them a code word is hand check, and they take the birds into a screening room. I walk through security. They make sure that there's no bombs, you know, underneath the birds. They'll sometimes swab or run the cage through and leave me with the birds. And then I would just walk onto the flight with a duffel bag with the cage inside and just stick it underneath my seat and don't tell the airlines about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I was surprised because we do the same thing. We travel with our dog, and my wife just carries them through security. Nobody has ever questioned. It's only the airlines that are, if they see them, you know, they're like, do you have the ticket or did you pay for that? But yeah, that's a wild. I was so surprised that they're like, "All right, that's a dog, or those are some birds." Okay.
Well, I've been kicked off of two flights.
Really?
Over 15 years. One was before 9/11, and it was only because I had gotten the birds on to the plane, but I didn't have a duffel bag for the cage, and on the top of the cage it said live animals. And as we were taking off to Chicago I was competing at Magi Fest, in Columbus. And the stewardess was like, live animals, what's that? She's like, is it a snake? She started freaking out. And she told the pilot, she's like, we got to kick this guy off. He's got birds. And he's like, well, we're about to take off. It's just birds. Like, chill out, lady. So we connected through Chicago on our way to Columbus. And in Chicago, two police officers greeted me off the plane, walked me off the plane, told me I had to get rid of the birds. And I smuggled them right back on, walked right back on to my connecting flight. No problem.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the other time was same reason. It was just Continental Airlines at the time didn't allow birds, you know, and they saw that I had birds. So,
jeez.
Yeah.
That sounds, to me, that's the most anxiety filled experience, but it yeah. seems like it's just super normal.
Well,
for you.
Now it is. Oh my God. But before it would give me the biggest like anxiety. Like I would dread going to the airport. I would just be so nervous. I would go like 2 hours early in case I got caught. And now I'm just like, traveling with my birds, you know, I got my bows like you, just totally like la la la.
Yeah, it becomes a zen experience.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? I love the movie Up in the Air, where he's, you know, getting behind specific types of people, and she's like, he goes, I stereotype, it's faster, and that's kind of what you have to do. You're just like, all right, those people are quicker. We're gonna go through there, put the headphones on, and then get on the plane.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think once you start traveling more and more, it's just, you don't, I think the stress does start to go away. Even if a plane is delayed or something, you're like, all right, this is what's happening. Yeah,
it's
sucks.
Like it's like any task, you know? Anything that you do over and over and over and over. I mean, gosh, I always like think about, I had a conversation once with Rick Thomas, and he was talking about his cats, his big tigers, and, you know, and it's just like something that he's done for so long where he gets up in the morning and like feeds these big old beasts, like,
jeez.
You know, and shovels their shit, and like it takes a lot of work, but he's like, yeah, but once you just do it over and over and over, it's just what you're used to doing.
Yeah,
you know, so you kind of just continue on with life like it's
you know, it's amazing how quickly you can adjust.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not the same thing, but
right.
You know, my wife and I recently moved to the second level of an apartment, and both of our dogs, you know, can't do steps because they're dachshunds, and we're like, we got to carry them down the steps every single day. And for like 2 days, it was exhausting. Yeah. And now it's just, pick him up, carry him, go up the elevator, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, it's wild how quickly the human mind will just adjust once that stress, or once you stop worrying about things.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that relates to performing too, in terms of like, I always, anytime I'm trying something new out, you'll always be super stressed out about it. Like, oh, this could happen, this can happen. And then you do it two or three times.
So stressful, yeah.
And you're like, what am I even worrying about?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm working on a few new close-up routines right now. And I always chicken out in the beginning. Like, when I'm doing strolling gigs, it's like, I'll like pull it out, be like, I'm going to do it for this. And then I just don't.
I did that Saturday. I worked on two or three, not new, but stuff I don't normally do.
Yeah.
Same thing, chickened out. I'm like, no, nope, not going to do it.
I'm not going to do it. I don't know why. It's like I have to get so comfortable with, I guess, non-paid clients and like people, the dry cleaner, my girlfriend or my parents, or, you know, like just people that I'm like, oh, well, if I mess this up, it's not going to be a big deal.
Yeah, you know? It's different when people are paying you, you know, especially like I did this gig over the weekend where like it was a house party and they wanted like all these references, and I'm like, I gave them my website and videos and like critical reviews and all those things you have up there that should sell you. And they still wanted past references and for a house party out of all the things. And you just start to go, all right, well, I guess I shouldn't try. I should do like all my good stuff because they're already doubting me.
right. Exactly.
I don't know. That's where you can get into your head again and weird things like that.
Yeah, it's so funny how, it is, it's kind of a heady, you know, job, you know? It's like you're thinking about all these different things. You're psychoanalyzing the audience to, like, see who's enjoying it and who would be good volunteers.
Yeah.
And you also want to perform well, and you're thinking about if you're smiling and having a good time and portraying that you're enjoying what you're doing. And so there's, so many aspects, I think, that the magician mind has to think about. And I think we utilize so many different parts of our brains at once. And it's just, it's, you know, when you're doing like accounting or whatever, it's like, it's very logical. It's like left brain. You're like staring at a screen and crunching numbers. You know?
Yeah.
So it's, I think it's rare when you have to, you know, be on in so many different points, you know?
Yeah. I think it just, you get, I don't know, you're able just to seamlessly transition from one part of your brain to the next, you know, once you've done it a bunch of times.
Totally.
What I'm always interested in, I usually save this towards the end, but whatever. Best gig experience, worst gig experience. I have quite a few worst experiences.
I have so many.
That I've brought up many times in the podcast. But
oh gosh, where
I'm
do
always
I even
fascinated.
Start? Where do I start? Worst gig experiences. Well, it's funny. I mean, I just kind of generally speaking, I would say that some of the worst gigs are like the ones that I volunteer for.
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
It's always the free stuff.
And it's like a nonprofit. They come to you and they're like, would you please, please like help us with this? And they're like, we'll treat you so well. We're
you
so
can
excited.
Hand out business cards.
Right, right, right. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to volunteer for this. Mm-hmm. And like, you go there with that like attitude of like, I'm helping, you know, like, and then they don't treat you well.
No.
And then they treat you like crap. And they're like, oh, just go set up in the corner. And like, and then they treat you like you're volunteering.
Yep. Yeah.
Or that, and then you charge a company $5,000 for a corporate. They're like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for being here.
Yep.
Can I get you anything? There's a bottle of champagne waiting in your 5-star suite. You know, like, can I buy you dinner right now? And you're like, wait, what is going on here?
Yeah, it's so backwards.
It's so backwards. So yeah, I would say a lot of the worst gigs are probably stem from that, mm-hmm. you know? Let's see. Do you have any like stories that you can think of off the top of your head?
I've told this before, but it's always the one that sticks out in my mind. I was in a giant banquet room of probably like 300 or 400 people, and they had no projection. It was just a tiny stage way at the end of the banquet room, and I was doing a show. And I was just tanking the whole time because nobody could see, really hear. And like, I messed up a book test and just like weird things were going wrong. And I barreled through it, got done. And I ended the show with, yeah, thanks. If you like me, Nick Paul. If you didn't like me, Chris Angel, blah, blah, blah. And then a guy walks on and he goes, all right, thanks, Chris Angel. You know, just like not even making a joke out of it, but totally serious that I think he just hated my show.
Oh, God.
And I had to walk with all of my stuff, equipment, through the audience because there was no back door to get to my car.
Oh,
so I'm like carrying
no.
all of my crap through this audience that hated me.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, that's probably one of the worst. That's the worst. That was like 5 years ago, so that was the worst I've had.
Yeah.
Well, everything since then has been, you know, smooth sailing.
I had a weird dream the other night that I showed up to a house party, and I roll in, and they're like, oh, go set up in this like room down the hall. So it's like I open up the front door, I go straight down a hall, and I'm like setting up in this like little den. And then I notice, I look straight down the hall out the front door, and everyone's sitting outside the house in the front yard. They set up all the chairs, mm-hmm. but the stage is still in the den.
Oh, wow.
All the way down this hall. And I start my show and I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be engaging like with these people. I can barely see like one guy in the front yard, but I had to continue this whole show, all the way down this den. It was just this weird idea, but I think it's, you know, analyzing that just now, it's like, I think it's that disconnection with the audience.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, when you're too far away from magic, you're just disengaged. And that goes back to my whole, you know, philosophy that magic is best close up, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, small rooms.
Yeah,
we were talking about that last
yeah.
week, too. And I think clients have this idea that, you know, it's like a music performance. You know, we'll watch it from down the hall.
Right.
And no, it has to be like comedy where you have to be engaged and you have to feel like this is happening live in the moment. Like you couldn't watch this on television.
Yeah, totally. I think some of the worst gigs are when, like, they're like, no, we're going to eat dinner while you perform.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And you're like, well, it's not really atmosphere entertainment. You know, it's not mm-hmm. like I'm a juggler where you can just like watch
glance
me.
Glance and, hey, look
right.
at that. Okay.
Like,
yeah.
My show's interactive. And mm-hmm. it's like you're stuffing your face with steak. It's very hard
sure.
to, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I always try to avoid those questions or avoid those situations with clients now. But.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard when you're just getting started and you don't know, you know, and you show up and I guess you have to go through all those bad shows to.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, they're looking back. It's good to go through those.
Yeah.
You learn. I always learn a lot more from failing than I do from if you have a good show. It's like, OK, that's good. And then you don't really pick up on like what specifically went correct.
Yeah.
What about we'll go positive here. What about best gig?
Best gigs.
You've done a lot of cool. I was looking over your website. You've done a lot of cool. You've been on television multiple times and things like that.
Yeah, I've done some cool things here in town. Some things that kind of like pop. I did Katy Perry's birthday party once.
Was that at the castle?
Yeah, so she rented the Magic Castle.
I saw that photo. That's cool.
And then I did. I was hired for the stage show, so I did like 30 or 45 minutes on the Palace stage. And that was just kind of wild because it was just like crazy personalities and people were dressed up and really drunk. And so that was pretty fun. I would have to say probably one of the coolest was Johnny Depp.
Oh, cool.
I would think like he's just one of the coolest actors I've ever met. He was just like, when I finished my show, he came up to me. He's like, "So is that it?" Like, I was like, he's like, "No." I was like, "Do you want to see like some card tricks or some close up?" He's like, "Yeah, here, come hang out with me and my friends outside."
That's awesome.
And he was just rolling his own cigarettes and he kept buying me drinks. And I just did like card tricks for him and his friends for like an hour. And it was so much fun. He was just like having a blast.
And then
like,
he put you in Pirates of the Caribbean
Six. Yeah.
we need a magician in this.
We need a
magician. I know this guy.
Right.
That's cool. That's a cool thing about the castle. He'll just randomly be performing for celebrities, it seems like.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The castle. I mean, what's great about the castle is that people go there to see magic. Mm-hmm. So they're excited to see you, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's rare, you know? That's like rare unless you're doing your own show at a theater and selling tickets.
Sure.
And, you know, so I think that's those are pretty fun. Some other shows that kind of stand out are like maybe performing for the troops. Like I've done some stuff in Kosovo and some stuff overseas for the troops. And those are always just kind of rewarding and feel good. And then, and occasionally I'll volunteer for like an orphanage down in Mexico. And those are just kind of crazy too. Just get like 600-700 orphans, you know, in an orphanage, you know, and trying to do your show in Spanish and just trying to interact. And these kids are just loving it, you know? So, you know, I like those experiences where you're doing it and you're like, okay, I'm doing this for a reason. You know, it's not just...
It's a different volunteer experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they actually are excited that you're there.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about future career goals? What's something that you haven't accomplished that you would like to?
Brain surgery.
Yeah.
Okay. That would be...
you can do that. Eight years of school, no problem.
Well, all kinds of stuff. I really love all aspects of performing, producing, directing, kind of behind the scenes and, you know, in front of the camera, so to speak. So I have like an animated sitcom that I've written. So I'd love to pick that back up one day. It's, you know, just very different creative outlet. I have, you know, of course, a TV show idea that I would love to eventually do. I love sketch comedy and like improv and stuff. So, you know, I'm always working on sketches and stuff with my girl, and we're always able to kind of, I don't know, jam on those and stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of different things. I don't think it's one specific like project. Like I have to be, you know, performing at the Bellagio by age 35, you know, with a 15-year contract. I thought I used to want that sort of like Vegas dream, but I don't anymore, you know. I like the freedom of being freelance and being able to work jobs for smaller amounts of time and kind of move away from them when you want. So, I'm kind of just stoked doing what I'm doing right now. And, you know.
Yeah, I think that that whole Vegas idea seems great, but anytime I've heard Penn and Teller talk about it, it's like, it's not that they're not grateful for their, you know, super long run down there in Vegas, but anytime they're touring, they say there's a noticeable difference in the audience, you know, just an energy change, you know, everybody's specifically going to see them as opposed to, oh, what are we going to do tonight? Oh, we'll go see Penn and Teller, you know, at 6 o'clock and the show's at 7.
Right.
And yeah, so I think it's certainly a cool thing to have a Vegas run, but there are drawbacks to it for sure.
Did you ever see Bill Bixby's The Magician, like in the 70s, 80s?
I don't know, maybe.
So it was this guy named Bill Bixby, and he had his own plane, and he had a Corvette that he would like drive out of the plane. So I used to think my dream was, I'll live in San Diego, I'll become a pilot, buy my own Cessna, have a show in Vegas, fly it to Vegas every day, and then like stop over in LA when I need, like during the day, to film a TV show.
Totally.
That was my dream, right? That was like completely logical, right?
Normal.
Yeah, completely normal. Yeah. Hour flights, you know, just like 1 hour from San Diego to LA, 1 hour to Vegas, you know.
That, which is kind of funny because that's kind of what Bill Burr is doing. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Bill Burr. That sounds familiar.
Comedian, but.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He just got his helicopter license, I think.
Did he really?
Maybe his pilot's too, but yeah, he's kind of doing that where he's just flying for gigs and things like that. But
that's usually how people end their careers. Yeah.
Or if you're Harrison Ford, you'll just keep surviving.
That's true, right?
He's crashed his plane, what, twice now?
Jesus, I don't
Maybe once, I don't know.
That's insane.
But, hey, you know, I'd love to get my pilot's license, but I'm terrified.
Yeah, it's the most dangerous type of flying, small planes and
Oh, is it really?
Helicopters, oh yeah.
I thought it'd be safer for planes because if the engine goes out, you can just glide down. But I guess if you don't know what you're doing, that doesn't really help. If you have a self-driving car. And last but not least, as we wrap things up here, is there anything that you're really... Because this is a... I always bring this up. It's kind of like a magic renaissance going now with television. And it's just so much magic for people to see, from like Carbonaro Effect to live stuff like The Illusionist touring. And any thoughts on that? Good, bad?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know. I think just magic on television right now is, it's just almost too saturated. There's almost just too much of it, you know. That. I remember being excited when I was a kid because there would be a Copperfield special, you know.
Yeah, it would happen once every couple of years.
Once every couple of years on, like, CBS, and it was on at, like, 8 p.m., and then everyone watched it, right? Yeah. There wasn't 1,000 channels where we could... you know, watch what we want, where we wanted it. So I think at that time, it was really cool. Like, magic on television was newer and it was unique.
Yeah.
But now it's just so much, you know. I mean, just with the internet and YouTube and being able to watch, you know, stuff, it seems that these magicians just need to do quick stuff that's edited like crazy.
Yeah.
And it's just not a good medium for you know, magic is better live.
Yeah.
Know? So it's just, it's just a tough, you know, parallel. And then I think also, like, technology hasn't really helped with, I mean, people just believe that anything's possible. So, you know, I mean, you watch movies, you know, you're like, well, that can happen. I you know, so when you watch TV, I feel like people just believe that anything can happen. So it's, you know, it's frustrating to, like...
Yeah, that's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, well, it's amazing. Eh, you probably just use Bluetooth.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. Right. And it's, you know, that's... it's just... They're just two different mediums, I think.
I think that's why it's important to go back to very analog styles of magic where, you know, you're just using pieces of paper. You're just using a deck of cards.
Yeah.
Just stuff that clearly can in no way be gimmicked by technology. I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah, I agree. I love, like, kind of trying to make things organic. That's what I try to do is, you know, how can I make this trick more organic? Yeah.
For me, it's like, how can I fit it into a tiny suitcase and travel carry-on? That's always my goal. It's like, does it have to fit into a big case? Not doing
it. No, it doesn't, right?
Mainly because I'm lazy.
Yeah.
But,
well, smart.
Well, I appreciate you doing this free podcast.
Yeah.
Very kind of you. Anything you want to promote?
Well, let's see. JoelWard.com.
There we go.
Any follow me on Twitter, Joel Ward.
Okay.
So
you have some great tweets. I follow
thank you.
I'm a fan.
Appreciate it.
There's Katy Perry photo, I think, is pinned on your Twitter. Correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a great, if you haven't seen it, it's very, her reaction is priceless.
I'm throwing a fireball towards the camera.
She looks like she's pissing her pants.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's hilarious.
Yeah.
In a great way.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, man.